Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. I hope you're all doing great. Thank you again for your kind words, the questions and comments that you've sent by email, and I continue to welcome those. It helps me to know how you're hearing this and to shape some of the discussion and application for this. So first, while we're on open mic, any additions, any questions, comments, or things that you've thought of you'd like to incorporate in the discussion? Anyone? While you're thinking, I want to add, as we begin to think about one way of creating a systematic way to go about understanding and facilitating change in a story, the roadmap system, as you probably saw, is the acronym for the 7 steps to really understand and revise a new story. These are the cumulative algorithms that comprise a story. Now, this is not an exercise to give a client. This is simply a way that we can think about and organize in our minds how to facilitate a collaboration with a client. And one way of doing that is to hear the client's story and to hear what's included, what's not, have a way to go about systematically examining that can guide and shape some of our questions and some of our interactions. So we each have the conviction that we see things as they are, that our beliefs and responses are determined by objective ways of looking at things. And just given the right information, other rational and reasonable people would reach the same conclusions we have. Now, you know by now that's not true. And if it were, we'd be out of business as mentor coaches. But here's a short list of some anatomical realities in our brains. Facts, beliefs, identity, patterns like attachment, emotional, behavioral patterns. We repeat the same thing and it hardwires. But change can occur, but it's basically internal, but it can occur in conjunction with a collaborative alliance with us as coaches, as a catalyst and a facilitator of that change. So whether we're hearing storylines that we may organize as money or wellness or career or relationship, or other more specific components like bias, belief, blind spot, the roadmap system is simply one to use that may be helpful. It's 6 steps of change and 1 process of transformation. So here's the simplest summary, and I'll go on lecture mode in just a moment, but I want to see if you had any response or question or clarification. A very simple summary of the roadmap system, those 7 steps. We decide 3 things: what we focus on, what it means, and what we do about it. These 3 steps are the foundation of writing your life story. Each are decisions and shape your future: focus, meaning, action. And that means simply that whatever we think, feel, and experience, we create each moment. We process and decide what we do and act on it. This is our story. So any comment or question before I go on lecture mode and begin to look with you in a more specific way about this way of understanding a story and how to change it? Any thoughts or additions or questions? Well, don't hesitate. If you have them during the time that you're listening, jot it down and we'll come back to it at the end, or you can send it by email. So hold on, I'll put us on lecture mode. We've discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. We're going to look now more closely at how to do that, the principles and practice of change. In this seminar, we're going to talk about the first four steps of the roadmap. And here is an overview, and this is in your outline. Here's an overview of the roadmap to inform change, to recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map strategies, author new experiences, and then program these new experiences into identity. So these seven steps are a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new one. It's a system of understanding and stepwise change that integrates psychology, neuroscience with strategic coaching. So we're going to focus it on a wellness story. So every step is simple, but that doesn't mean it's easy. The actual implementation of the ideas can be tough because it often requires us to change the way we think about things, like breaking bad or outdated habits, developing new ones, remaining disciplined over the long term. The first three steps are about awareness, a systematic way to ask questions of yourself or of your clients. First, recognize authorship of your wellness story. Now, remember the premise. Each moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. That means that it's not what happens to us. What we experience, we either create or we accept. But sometimes the story so close to us, our own, is really difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past and ending an old story are important, but they're not enough. You're listening to somebody who was a card-carrying psychoanalyst for over two decades. Coming to the end of the past is not enough. We have a much more exciting, vigorous, and effective way of helping someone create a new story in coaching. Now, how can we tell our life, or in this case, we're going to use consistently a wellness story to ourselves in order to know what works and what needs to change? So there are four principles for this first step to recognize authorship, to recognize that we're writing the story. One, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg, stakes the rope in the ground, and the baby elephant may initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. So the baby elephant stays in the area determined by the length of the rope. Now, fast forward, this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, 6 to 7 tons. It could easily break that rope, but it doesn't, because earlier, as a baby, it couldn't. The adult elephant is constrained by the assumption based on an earlier experience. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that determines behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same result. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Second principle, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what's around us, including what we select, what we register, and how we process it. We construct storylines in this active way. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect. we always make our beliefs come true. We act in a way to teach people how to respond to us as well. This actualizes beliefs and validates assumptions. Third principle, a new story can only occur in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's intentions, you can affect their behavior. When people are asked if they intend to do something, they're way more likely to act according to how they answer. If you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car in the next 6 months?" The question increased purchase rates during that time period of 35%. Large group of people matched as much as possible. Other behaviors with increased frequency. Ask if people intend to work out, to exercise. It's something I wanted to respond to a question that that I got from one of you in the beginning about how to bring in the concept of wellness. Actually, the only thing that I do that directly relates to all that we are talking about is initially with a new client, in addition to having them fill out the client information packet, as we're discussing what the client wants to do, I may ask them, "Do you work out?" And that's all. I may log that in and come back to it at a later point. But it gives me information, and it gives both of us a focus on mind, body, spirit that may need to be incorporated or addressed in coaching. Fourth principle. Our minds seek closure and infer causality whether it's accurate or not. A number of research findings show that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons they do what they do, but if they're asked for a reason, they readily give one. What that does, and here's a practical application of what that means. If you ask a client a why question, they're going to immediately tell you their why. Now, two things. One is that disrupts the flow of their describing their experience and engaging you with it because you're asking them to suddenly stop that flow and move to an entirely different part of their brain, their left prefrontal cortex, and come up with a reason that they did it. Now, in the vast majority of cases, it will not be cause and effect. But what it does is bring closure so that they don't have to think about it anymore, and it seems to make sense, even though it's not actually cause and effect. The same kind of thing happens when a client wants you to give advice or tell them what to do or give them a multiple choice because they can foreclose consideration and the discomfort of not knowing or exploration by you giving advice. And although that doesn't work, it's still easier for both coach and client because there's not the discomfort of not knowing and exploring in a way that you don't know. Remember the example I gave of the patients who get expert advice from a physician in the form of a prescription. Less than 50% fill it. Less than 50% of those take it as direct. Expert advice, less than 1 in 4 people actually follow it. So basically it doesn't work. No matter what it does in the brain, it doesn't work. And that's why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other kind of mental gymnastics to bring closure without ownership or growth. It's like a finish without an ending. So, review this exercise in step one in the workbook. Recognize authorship of your story. I'd suggest that you look at each exercise in step one before moving to step two. Look at them, pick one that may appeal to you, but especially look at this exercise on page 1.5 in the workbook about recognizing authorship of your own story. Second step, own your story. And for this, I'd suggest reviewing the assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. Set an appointment with yourself, spend a few minutes on page 1.7 in the workbook. So basically this is from an infinite sea of possibilities. Our beliefs determine what we actually see, how we process it, and then how we decide. It's our software package. So adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we already process daily, like adding a new diet or a health club membership, that probably won't have an impact unless you change the software. We'll come back to that, and I have some vivid examples about that. So here's an equation that I think might be helpful to really look at how a storyline is constructed to see if it informs questions as you're talking with a client. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drive performance. So if someone is not performing optimally or as they want, look at the antecedent. Look at the behavior. Well, I feel stuck. What behavior would we see that indicates that you're addressing that to not be stuck? So here's some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to work out 6 days a week. Limiting beliefs can also influence reality and behavior. And a limiting belief can foreclose exploration. A limiting belief may be, well, I need to have confidence before I can start. Well, I need to be totally ready. Or I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. A fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about point of reference and active versus passive. These are things that we can listen for in listening to how our client constructs a story that can be useful. This is also why I request with a client in the beginning, may I interrupt you at some point if I feel it might be helpful for both of us to look at what you just said? And I give them permission to interrupt me too because there's something I may have said that doesn't make sense. So I want to look at it together collaboratively as soon as it occurs instead of, you know, doing the socially correct thing and waiting until three paragraphs later and going back to it. Now, point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories may have a premise of an external point of reference. You can hear that by listening to how they construct their stories. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They may react to situations they're in rather than proactively planning. So here are some typical ways that that will show itself, an external point of reference. So another way to say that is here's a list of coachable moments. They may feel as if they have little or no control over some aspect or some person in their life. Well, this is just happening. There's nothing I can do. They may feel vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They may see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. Or If they experience a symptom in their body, they may medicate it away or ignore it. That's like turning off the indicator when the warning light on your dash says something's wrong. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference. This is what we coach toward. An internal point of reference will see their authority as their own. They know they're writing their own story. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. They know that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. This results in feeling effective. So here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result. Then look for alternatives and listen for each of these, how we can make a coachable moment out of the antithesis of some of these characteristics that we want to help a client move toward. If they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and initiate that change. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, here's a related notion that you can also hear how someone views this just in the construction of their language to recognize active versus passive positions. This is a consideration of how someone sees themselves vis-a-vis their own authority. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away with me. Each of these, again, coachable moments. This just seems to keep happening. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. So, these two steps, to recognize and own your story. Step three, assess the storylines and the plot. Here's something that I frequently ask a client to do. The two exercises, they're brief exercises, to distinguish and address ideals and needs. Page 1.12 and 1.14 in the workbook. I believe it's helpful for both the client and for me to know their ideals, what their real sense of purpose is, and their needs to see how much, once crystallizing an awareness of how much they're meeting their own needs. So this is helpful to know if someone is planning a strategy to look at, is all of them going in the same direction, their needs, their ideals, their strategy, and their goals, when all of that goes in the same direction, it's significantly more effective. Now, ideals and needs are part of a core of identity, part of a foundation of a sense of self. Our ideals serve as a personal model of value. It's an internal guide to purpose. It informs passion. Living up to a personal, attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. Living up to your ideal is the only place I know that self-esteem comes from. Failure to live up to an internal ideal is a feeling of shame. A need is an essential requirement, a necessity for mind, body, spirit. Of all of the exercises and tools of a needs and ideals assessment, I think can be very helpful. I will, for a new client, put their top three needs and their top three ideals inside the cover of a folder that I'll open, and if I want to write down anything that they commit to do or whatever, but I have that to refer to so that they and I will be incorporating what is fundamental to their identity, parts of their identity. So part of the assessment of your wellness story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. This is what we help our clients do. We each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of all of them or even of having some, but just assume that we see things the way they are. Now, the brain has a mind of its own, and we are often of two or more minds. The prefrontal cortex says, let's set up an exercise program and plan the savings. The limbic system says, let's have the cheesecake and order the big screen HD TV. Each struggles possibly over the same dollar, hopefully not tearing it. One of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. This is something that we have in mind, I believe, necessarily in working with our clients, that we help them to become more aware of their own experience, to become more subjectively and objectively aware of their experience. A couple of studies that are very related, one reported in Scientific American Mind, another reported in Harvard Business Review, found that the most singular quality that was correlated with success in executives was this ability to self-regulate and self-reflect, to manage their emotions and be self-reflective. And that trumped the next five characteristics, including degree, business school, a whole number of variables. Now, I think that was the case simply because executives are what they measured. I think that's the case with everyone, that we often will help a client in the process of regulating a state of mind and managing emotion to, for example, create the best mindset to engage something that they're dealing with. One of the unique qualities we have, as I mentioned, is self-awareness. That's why we can create a new story. We are not that old story. We created the old story. We're not our habits or our thoughts. And let me mention also, I've said it before, and you guys know already I'm not above being redundant. Our clients don't see what they're telling us, what they're engaging with. They don't see it as their story. It's not a story. It's just the way things are. Story is the metaphor for us to organize ways of understanding, ways of collaboratively engaging someone to look at something and to consider possibilities. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So, in your wellness story, is all of you going in the same direction? Do all of your storylines advance the plot? Here are a couple of other ways to listen to a story, yours included. Listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person or group or culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create the outside to match the inside. So pay attention to what you say, what you consistently like and dislike in another. And don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Probably the most succinct summary of this was by James Baldwin in Take This Hammer. What you say about somebody else, anybody else, reveals you. Listen for repetitions of the old story. Recognizing and owning your story is necessary. It's prerequisite to assessing change. And remember this. Whatever remains unconscious can be attributed to fate. We're always reaching our goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious. So it's helpful to know specifically what they are so that we can revise them and orient what we really want to be the specific goals. For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. And here are a couple things to consider. Your ideal body self is not your body self or body image 25 years ago. It's not somebody you admire at the club or on the screen. Here's an example. When someone successfully loses weight, unless they actually change their body image, they will gain back that weight plus about 3 pounds. If they change their body image, they're more likely to keep that weight off. So listen to the language. There's a visualization exercise in the addendum to the workbook. Listen to your language regarding your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure or even commitment. Trying immediately says, there's not a full commitment. It's a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. You know the words of somebody who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction by not being totally committed. They create an out. When someone says, well, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know that they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. That's what you want at the end of your coaching session, after you get someone to summarize the most important takeaway, if you decide to do that, which I highly recommend, and then ask, based on our discussion, what do you commit to do before we meet again? Listen for the time frame, the before we meet again. Otherwise, SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end for time bound. Listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, rest well, at the time, and later. A huge, delicious dessert will taste great at the moment, but the residual feeling and awareness of regret will last way longer than the immediate pleasure of the good taste. And reflect on what studies, but also what your experience says. The major taste impact, up to 80%, is in the first 3 bites. After that, it's redundant. There's accommodation. Your body accommodates to the sensation. So why go more than 2 or 3 bites? Coke addicts know this. The hard stuff, not the soft drink, who describe they chase the first high of that initial use for the rest of their using history. So listen to your body. Acknowledge and accept its somatic language. Acknowledge what works and what doesn't. Hear your body speak when you eat too much, when you eat foods that aren't healthy, when you drink too much. It is not rocket science. Listen to your body. It's sensitive, accurate, it's immediate. Pay attention to the message when you work out, when you feel refreshed by taking care of yourself. the experience even of a 1 or 2 minute mindfulness meditation. It has an impact immediately. It also has an impact on your immune system. Your body makes you accountable. A physical symptom contains the message, yet importantly, it is the message. Symptoms give disguised voice to what you avoid hearing or knowing. A symptom is a sentinel of a process that begs to be understood, listened to rather than silent, respected rather than disregarded. A symptom is a storyline that needs to be heard, and it will repeat until translated. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout, including your body. And somatic language is literal. A pain in the neck, purging something, churning gut, weeping skin, hypertension. A psychological symptom answers a question not asked consciously and proffers a story with its own history, dynamics, and meanings. Here's Milrad Pavic saying this way better and way shorter than me. It's easier to fall ill than learn the truth. So take care of your maladies. They always have something to tell you. You are the author, not the victim of your symptom. And repeating one more time, when you listen to whispers, no one needs to shout. So, step 4, decide what to change. I would suggest 2 references as exercises here in Module 2. 4 basic inquiries for storyline evaluation, page 2.4, and 15 reflections to understand your storyline. Page 2.10. Now, a precept for this step. Part of the struggle for people to embrace change is because the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. Now, I would say we're addressing that very specifically about being in synchrony with how the mind and brain work. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people don't make change even when they know it's in their own best interest. Your identity is not your behavior or habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated, a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. Well, I'm a procrastinator. People become the stories of who they think they are. Remember the principle from step 2. In adulthood, you either create your reality or agree to it. For this, you have to recognize and own your wellness story. So let's look at what's involved in deciding to change, to author new experiences. So here are some ways of how the brain opposes change. This is, I think, really helpful to understand because we engage change. We help in the choice architecture of a client deciding at any moment what they do. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. From the cognitive sciences, we know how to change a personal or business story. So let's look at how we can be informed about that, how the brain opposes change, and how to use this to facilitate success. Since the brain has a mind of its own, we need to consider, I believe, 10 precepts of how our brains work. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new wellness story. Now, the mechanisms are complex at times, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. 1, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated, that have become hardwired, these neural pathways and neuronal networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. You don't have to think about how you drive to work each day, because this becomes a default mode. So you can think about other things. Listen to a book. It's energy efficient. Now, as soon as there's disruption of that, like with construction, you have to think about it, snake your way through neighborhood. You don't get to have attention to the book. So the script is broken. And when you think about it, this is a whole other seminar series, but this is what we do with our clients. We help them break a script when that script may be limiting or in some ways less than successful. When habits are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain get activated. They're disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process that thinking. So basically, it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so the brain opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Ray Kurzweil said, "Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." I heard him say this in person as he was discussing his book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. 2, change creates dissonance. Now, couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine because it's hardwired, and our inclination to expect what we already know. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We screen information and see it as validation. So people don't see what they don't expect to see. In fact, the brain's error detection mechanism reads something different, something unexpected, as if it's wrong. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors. It's the difference between what we're already wired for, what we expect, and what is different from that. So it registers as a sense that something's not right. It can be abrupt and explicit, or it can be something that simply registers as something's not quite right, or my intuition is telling me that this is not right. Now, the good news, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means that this part of the brain becomes active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So that means it responds to mistakes. This is great. And we just have to remember to discern whether it's a mistake or it's a neural response and print out to change itself. A simple example, your client does something that's new and different. They get an immediate read of discomfort because they've stepped away from their default mode, even a single step. And if they read it as, well, my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing, or my gut says this is wrong, that's a misread, and this is where we want to help them reframe that as a recognition, the experience of doing something new and different, to frame it as a signpost of being in new territory, validation that they're moving ahead. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. Take a pen. I want to tell you some numbers and have you write them down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Maybe 3 and 6? Multiples of 3? Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts that a third rise will follow. Extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how this brain repetition of pattern is also the basis of some jokes, listing a couple of things, then a third non sequitur. Set up, payoff. Our brains automatically impose patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to sometimes make wise and balanced decisions, especially when those decisions are new and different, unprecedented situation. We'll come back to that. So we need to be sure we predict, even envision, the right things. How the brain opposes change? 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Consider, you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. What do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire because both focus on short term, draw attention away from work, and focus on the negative. Recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do can result in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. If you've been anywhere with me over evolutionary time, you'll realize avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. You do not have to be motivated in order to change. You only need 2 things, a plan and to stick to it. Many of the athletes and actors I've worked with, they go to the gym 6 days a week. They're not motivated to do it, but they do it because they need to do it in order to do what's next. So they have a plan, a system, and they do it. And they stick to it. 6, emotions change brain functioning. This is something we listen for in beginning with a client to see if they are grounded and centered to really engage with us in a meaningful conversation. When they're grounded and centered, they have access to all the information in all of their states of mind. And sometimes simply resonating with their experience can help ground and center them. Someone begins with, I've just had this really upsetting thing. And we may simply say, I hear how upsetting that's been for you. And that is helpful enough to get grounded and centered, engage with us in an exploration. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term enhance learning, but the window is up to maybe 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things can go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So that means with sustained stress, people can make compromised decisions. So this is, again, why regulation of states of mind and management of emotion is so important and something we listen for with our clients. And under stress, we tend to do two things. We slip back to an earlier mode and hyper-focus on the most recent emotional events and maybe lose the big picture. Number eight, how the brain opposes change, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as being in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. This is a challenge I see with family succession of business. The founder has been in charge for 32 years and suddenly passed on to new operators, executives, owners. That transition is huge, and roles and scripts have to be rewritten. So this is a challenge as coaches to open a closed system, to empathically challenge, to strategically perturbate. We help a client break the script in areas where it may be important to try out something new. Now, the last two principles I think are huge for coaching. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients: co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bus, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that's specifically connected to creativity and memory. In repeated lab studies, mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of hippocampal cells. The cells, the part of the brain involved with creativity and memory. What's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100% increase. And recently, these findings were replicated in humans, London taxicab drivers, and medical students at the University of Hamburg. Another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. It goes in the other direction to decrease the number of cells in the hippocampus. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, usually that arm had been put in a sling to protect any further damage to occur, but instead, physicians put the good arm in a sling. After 10 days of therapy, the patients regained significant use of an arm that they thought would always hang useless because they had to use it. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. So here's another example. Not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. An example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same for the dominant hand of a classical guitarist. Now, the good news is we're not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed, new highways to new communities in your brain. And some important new research shows consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. So here's a brief summary of what neuroscience teaches us about change to perhaps apply to your wellness story. Everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. This means that existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway and network in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact in the brain. They cannot simply be moved or just overwritten by another fact, but they do atrophy with disuse, and other networks can take their place, unlearning. But it's an inside job. A teacher just can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network in the student's brain. This is why our primary engagement is a collaborative framework to focus on the client and their evolving story. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is why fixing doesn't work. You can't just list the four reasons an idea is wrong and expect it will rearrange someone's neural network, or what would be better if they did as an exercise program. That's not what we do to start with as coaches. Four, partly because it's complex and partly because it's subjective reality. Someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Remember, we began with saying 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This is the adaptive unconscious. This means we have to infer and listen for the algorithms of behavior, feeling, interaction. Here's a story that I think will illustrate that. Some penguins wanted to learn to fly, and they got together and hired a coach who was expert at this. They did an all-day seminar. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations. After a few hours, one penguin flew a short distance. Then others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. Change is a process, not an event. We're in discussion mode now. If there are any questions or comments, anything you want to add or ask, manage the background noise if you would. If you're moving around, do mute. But if you're ready to talk, unmute or star six. Any thoughts or questions or additions? Well, I hope this has been helpful. If you have thoughts, questions, or any kind of follow-up, feel free to fire off an email. Does anyone want to offer your most important takeaway from this seminar? I think it's always helpful to hear what our colleagues are hearing and what they take away. Take a chance. Somebody offer something that's been helpful to you? Well, if you think of anything, or have it written down, or think of it after we have hung up, fire it off in an email. I'll be eager to hear it. And thanks to all of you who have sent questions and responses still to those initial two questions. I look forward to picking up right here next time. We will resume on the roadmap. And again, thoughts, questions, suggestions, feel free to email me. Thanks very much for your attention, and I appreciate the correspondence in between. Hope you guys take really good care of yourselves and look forward to picking up right here next time. See you now.